5. Cosmic Strings. In the Next Generation episode, The Loss, the crew of the Enterprise encounters two-dimensional beings who have lost their way. These beings live on a cosmic string fragment. In the episode, this is described as an infinitesimally thin filament in space, with a very strong gravitational pull and vibrating with a characteristic set of subspace frequencies. In fact, cosmic strings are objects proposed to have been created during a phase transition in the early universe. Their properties would be similar, in some respects, to the objects encountered by the Enterprise. During a phase transition in materials, as when water boils or freezes, the configuration of the material's constituent particles changes. When water freezes, it forms a crystalline structure. As crystals aligned in various directions grow, they can meet to form random lines, which create the patterns that look so pretty on a window in the winter. During a phase transition in the early universe, the configuration of matter, radiation, and empty space, which I remind you can carry energy, changes as well. Sometimes during these transitions, various regions of the universe relax into different configurations. As these configurations grow, they too can eventually meet, sometimes at a point, and sometimes along a line, marking a boundary between the regions. Energy becomes trapped in this boundary line, and it forms what we call a cosmic string. We have no idea whether cosmic strings actually were created in the early universe, but if they were, and lasted up to the present time, they could produce some fascinating effects. They would be infinitesimally thin, thinner than a proton, yet the mass density they carry would be enormous, up to 1,000,000 tons per centimeter. They might form the seeds around which matter collapses to form galaxies, for example. They would also vibrate, producing not subspace harmonics, but gravitational waves. Indeed, we may well detect the gravitational wave signature of cosmic strings before we ever directly observe the strings themselves. So much for the similarities with the Star Trek string. Now for the differences. Because of the way they are formed, cosmic strings cannot exist in fragments. They have to exist either in closed loops or as a single long string that winds its way throughout the entire universe. And in spite of their large mass density, cosmic strings exert no gravitational force on faraway objects. Only if a cosmic string moves past an object will the object experience a sudden gravitational force. These are subtle points, however. On the whole, the Star Trek writers have done pretty well by cosmic strings. 6. Quantum Measurements. There was a wonderful episode in the final season of The Next Generation called Parallels, in which Worf begins to jump between different quantum realities. The episode touches, albeit incorrectly, on one of the most fascinating aspects of quantum mechanics, quantum measurement theory. Since we live on a scale at which quantum mechanical phenomena are not directly observed, our entire intuitive physical picture of the universe is classical in character. When we discuss quantum mechanics, we generally use classical language, so as to try and explain the quantum mechanical world in terms we understand. This approach, which is usually referred to as the interpretation of quantum mechanics, and so fascinates some philosophers of science, is benighted. What we really should be discussing is the interpretation of classical mechanics. That is, how can the classical world we see, which is only an approximation of the underlying reality, which is in turn quantum mechanical in nature, be understood in terms of the proper quantum mechanical variables. If we insist on interpreting quantum mechanical phenomena in terms of classical concepts, we will inevitably encounter phenomena that seem paradoxical or impossible. This is as it should be. Classical mechanics cannot account properly for quantum mechanical phenomena, and so there is no reason that classical descriptions should make sense. Having issued this caveat, I will describe the relevant issues in classical mechanical terms because these are the only tools of language I have. While I have the proper mathematical terms to describe quantum mechanics, like all other physicists, I have recourse only to a classical mental picture because all my direct experience is classical. As I have already said, one of the most remarkable features of quantum mechanics is that objects observed to have some property cannot be said to have had that property the instant before the observation. The observation process can change the character of the physical system under consideration. The quantum mechanical wave function of a system describes completely the configuration of this system at any one time, and this wave function evolves according to deterministic laws of physics. However, what makes things seem so screwy is that this wave function can encompass two or more mutually exclusive configurations at the same time. For example, if a particle is spinning clockwise, we say that its spin is up. If it is spinning counterclockwise, we say that its spin is down. Now, the quantum mechanical wave function of this particle can incorporate a sum with equal probabilities, spin up and spin down. If you measure the direction of the spin, you will measure either spin up or spin down. Once you have made the measurement, the wave function of the particle will from then on include only the component you measured the particle to have. If you measured spin up, you will go on measuring the same value for the particle. This picture presents problems. How, you may ask, can the particle have had both spin up and spin down before the measurement? The correct answer is that it had neither. The configuration of its spin was indeterminate before the measurement. The fact that the quantum mechanical wave function that describes objects does not correspond to unique values for observables is especially disturbing when one begins to think of living objects. There is a famous paradox called Schrödinger's cat, named after a physicist, Erwin Schrödinger. He was one of the young Turks in their 20s who, early in the century, helped uncover the laws of quantum mechanics. The equation describing the time evolution of the quantum mechanical wave function is known as Schrödinger's equation. Back to Schrödinger's cat. Imagine a box, inside of which is a cat. Inside the box, aimed at the cat, is a gun, which is hooked up to a radioactive source. The radioactive source has a certain quantum mechanical probability of decaying at any given time. When the source decays, the gun will fire and kill the cat. Thus, the wave function describing the cat, before I opened the box, could be said to be a linear superposition of a live cat and a dead cat. But this seems absurd. Similarly, our consciousness is always unique, never indeterminate. Is the act of consciousness a measurement? If so, then it could be said that at any instant there is a non-zero quantum mechanical probability for a number of different outcomes to occur, and our act of consciousness determines which outcome we experience. Reality then has an infinite number of branches. At every instance, our consciousness determines which branch we inhabit, but an infinite number of other possibilities exist a priori. This many-worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics is apparently the basis for poor Worf's misery. Indeed, Data says as much during the episode. When Worf's ship traverses a quantum fissure in space-time, while simultaneously emitting a subspace pulse, the barriers between quantum realities break down, and Worf begins to jump from one branch of the wave function to another at random times, experiencing numerous alternative quantum realities. This can never happen, of course, because once a measurement has been made, the system, including the measuring apparatus, Worf in this case, has changed. Once Worf has an experience, there is no going back, or perhaps I should say sideways. The experience itself is enough to fix reality. The very nature of quantum mechanics demands this. The whole point of the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, or any other interpretation of quantum mechanics for that matter, is that you can never experience more than one world at a time. And thankfully, there are other laws of physics that would prevent the appearance of millions of enterprises from different realities, as happens at the end of the episode. Simple conservation of energy, a purely classical concept, is enough to forbid it. 7. Solitons. In the Next Generation episode, New Ground, the Enterprise assists in an experiment developed by Dr. Ja Dore of the planet Bilana 3. Here, a soliton wave, a non-dispersing wavefront of subspace distortion, is used to propel a test ship into warp speed without the need for warp drive. The system requires a planet at the far end of the voyage, which will deliver a scattering field to dissipate the wave. The experiment nearly results in disaster, which is of course averted at the last instant. Solitons are not an invention of the Star Trek writers. The term is short for solitary wave and refers to a phenomenon observed originally in water waves. As described by John Scott Russell in 1834, when observing the motion of canal boats in England, the mass of water in the channel, which the suddenly halted boat had put in motion, accumulated around the prow of the vessel in a state of violent agitation, then suddenly leaving it behind, rolled forward with great velocity, assuming the form of a large solitary elevation, a rounded, smooth, and well-defined heap of water, which continued its course along the channel, apparently without change of form or diminution of speed. Solitons are non-dissipative, classically extended objects that can propagate from point to point. In fact, for this reason, the disasters that drive the plot in new ground could not happen. First of all, the soliton would not emit a great deal of radio interference. If it did, it would be dissipating its energy. For the same reason, it would not continue to gain energy or change frequency. Normal waves are extended objects that tend to dissipate their energy as they travel. However, classical forces, resulting from some interaction throughout space called a field, generally keep solitons intact, so that they can propagate without losing energy to the environment. Because they are self-contained energetic solutions of the equations describing motion, they behave, in principle, just like fundamental objects, like elementary particles. In fact, in certain mathematical models of the strong interaction holding quarks together, the proton could be viewed as a soliton, in which case we are all made of solitons. New fields have been proposed in elementary particle physics which may coalesce into soliton stars, objects that are the size of stars but involve a single coherent field. Such objects have yet to be observed, but they may well exist. 8. Quasars. In the episode The Pegasus, wherein we learn about the Treaty of Algon, which forbade the Federation to use cloaking devices, we find Picard's Enterprise exploring the Macquarie Quasar. Earlier, in the original series episode The Galileo 7, we learned that the original Enterprise had standing orders to investigate these objects whenever they might be encountered. But neither ship would in fact likely ever encounter a quasar while touring the outskirts of our galaxy. This is because quasars are the most energetic objects yet known in the universe. They radiate energies comparable to those of entire galaxies, yet they are so small that they are unresolvable by telescopes. Quasars are thought to be enormous black holes at the center of some galaxies, and to be literally swallowing up the central mass of their hosts. This is the only mechanism yet proposed that can explain the observed energies and size scales of quasars. As matter falls into a black hole, it radiates a great deal of energy and loses its potential gravitational energy in the process. If million or billion solar mass black holes exist at the centers of some galaxies, they can swallow whole star systems, which in turn will radiate the necessary energy to make up the quasar signal. For this reason, quasars are often part of what we call active galactic nuclei. Also, for this reason, you would not want to encounter one of these objects up close. The encounter would be fatal. 9. Neutrinos. Neutrinos are my favorite particles in nature, which is why I saved them for last. I've spent a fair fraction of my own research on these critters because we know so little about them, yet they promise to teach us much about the fundamental structure of matter and the nature of the universe. Many times, in various Star Trek episodes, neutrinos are either used or measured on starships. For example, elevated neutrino readings are usually measured as objects traverse the Bajoran wormhole. We also learn in the episode The Enemy that Geordi LaForge's visor can detect neutrinos, when a neutrino beacon is sent to locate him so that he can be rescued from an inhospitable planet. A neutrino field is encountered in the episode Power Play, and momentarily interferes with the attempt to transport some non-corporeal criminal life forms aboard the Enterprise. Neutrinos were first predicted to exist as a result of a puzzle related to the decay of neutrons. While neutrons are stable inside atomic nuclei, free neutrons are observed to decay in an average time of about 10 minutes into protons and electrons. The electric charge works out fine because a neutron is electrically neutral, while a proton has a positive charge and an electron an equal and opposite negative charge. The mass of a proton plus an electron is almost as much as the mass of a neutron. So there's not much free energy left to produce other massive particles in the decay in any case. However, sometimes the proton and electron are observed to travel off in the same direction during the decay. This is impossible, because each emitted particle carries momentum. If the original neutron was at rest, it had zero momentum. So something else would have to be emitted in the decay to carry off the momentum in the opposite direction. Such a hypothetical particle was proposed by Wolfgang Pauli in the 1930s and was named a neutrino, for a little neutron, by Enrico Fermi. He chose this name because Pauli's particle had to be electrically neutral in order not to spoil the charge conservation in the decay, and had to have, at most, a very small mass in order to be produced with the energy available after the proton and electron were emitted. Because neutrinos are electrically neutral, and because they do not feel the strong force which binds quarks and helps hold the nucleus together, they interact only very weakly with normal matter. Yet because neutrinos are produced in nuclear reactions, like those that power the sun, they are everywhere. 600 billion neutrinos per second pierce every square centimeter of your body every second of every day coming from the sun. An inexorable onslaught that has even inspired a poem by John Updike. You don't notice the neutrino siege because the neutrinos pass right through your body without a trace. On average, these solar neutrinos could go through 10,000 light-years of solid material before interacting with any of it. If this is the case, then how can we be sure that neutrinos exist, other than in theory, you may ask? Well, the wonderful thing about quantum mechanics is that it yields probabilities. That is why I said on average earlier. While most neutrinos will travel 10,000 light-years through solid matter without interacting with anything, if one has enough neutrinos and a big enough target, one can get lucky. This principle was first put to use in 1956 by Frederick Rhinus and Clyde Cowan, who put a several-ton target near a nuclear reactor and indeed observed a few events. This empirical discovery of the neutrino, actually the antineutrino, occurred more than 20 years after it was posited, and well after most physicists had accepted its existence. Nowadays, we use much larger detectors. The first observation of solar neutrinos was made in the 1960s by Ray Davis and collaborators using 100,000 gallons of cleaning fluid in a tank underground at the Homestake gold mine in South Dakota. In Davis's experiment, each day, on average, one neutrino from the sun would interact with an atom of chlorine and turn it into an atom of argon. It is a tribute to these experimenters that they could detect nuclear alchemy at such a small rate. It turns out that the rate that their detector and all subsequent solar neutrino detectors measured is different from the predicted rate. This puzzle, called the solar neutrino puzzle, could signal the need for new fundamental physics. The biggest neutrino detector in the world is being built in the Kamiokande mine in Japan. Containing over 30,000 tons of water, it will be the successor to a 5,000-ton detector, which is one of two neutrino detectors to see a handful of neutrinos from a 1987 supernova in the Large Magellanic Cloud, more than 150,000 light-years away. Which brings me back to where I began. Neutrinos are one of the new tools physicists are using to open windows on the universe. By exploiting every kind of elementary particle detection possible, along with our conventional electromagnetic detectors, we may well uncover the secrets of the galaxy long before we are able to venture out and explore it. Of course, if it were possible to invent a neutrino detector the size of Geordi's visor, that would be a great help. Any sensible Trekker physicist recognizes that Star Trek must be taken with a rather large grain of salt. Nevertheless, there are times when, for one reason or another, the Star Trek writers cross the boundaries from the merely vague or implausible to the utterly impossible. While finding even obscure technical flaws with each episode is a universal Trekker pastime, it is not the subtle errors that physicists and physics students seem to relish catching. It's the really big ones that are most talked about over lunch and at coffee breaks during professional meetings. To be fair, sometimes a sweet piece of physics in the series, even a minor moment, can trigger a morning after discussion at coffee time. Indeed, I remember vividly the day when a former graduate student of mine at Yale, Martin White, who's now at the University of Chicago, came into my office fresh from seeing Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. I had thought we were going to talk about gravitational waves from the early universe, but instead, Martin started raving about one particular scene from the movie, a scene that lasted all of about 15 seconds. Two helmeted assassins board Chancellor Gorkon's vessel, which has been disabled by photon torpedoes fired from the Enterprise, and is thus in zero gravity conditions. And the assassins shoot everyone in sight, including Gorkon. What impressed Martin, and to my surprise, a number of other physics students and faculty I discussed the movie with, was that the drops of blood flying around the ship were spherical. On Earth, all drops of liquid are tear-shaped because of the relentless pull of gravity. In a region devoid of gravity, like Gorkon's ship, even tears would be spherical. Physicists know this but seldom have the opportunity to see it. So by getting this simple fact perfectly right, the Star Trek special effects people made a lot of physics types happy. It doesn't take that much. But the mistakes also keep us going. In fact, what may be the most memorable Star Trek mistake mentioned by a physicist doesn't involve physics at all. It was reported to me by the particle physicist and science writer Steven Weinberg, who won the Nobel Prize for helping discover what is now called the Standard Model of Elementary Particle Interactions. As I knew that he keeps the TV on while doing intricate calculations, I wrote to him and asked him for his Star Trek memories. Weinberg replied that the main mistake made on Star Trek is to split an infinitive every damn time to boldly go. More often than not, though, it is the physics errors that get the attention of physicists. I think this is because these mistakes validate the perception of many physicists that physics is far removed from popular culture, not to mention the superior feeling it gives us to joke about the English majors who write the show. Here is my list of favorite blunders, gleaned from discussions with other physicists and email from Technitrekkers. I have made an effort here to focus mostly, but not exclusively, on blunders of down-to-earth physics. For example, I don't address such popular complaints as, why does the starlight spread out whenever warp speed is engaged? And the like. Similarly, I ignore here the technobabble, the indiscriminate use of scientific and pseudoscientific terminology used during each episode to give the flavor of futuristic technology. Finally, I have tried for the most part to choose examples I haven't discussed before. 1. In space, no one can hear you scream. The promo for Alien got it right, but Star Trek usually doesn't. Sound waves do not travel in empty space. Yet when a space station orbiting the planet Tanuga 4 blows up, from our vantage point aboard the Enterprise, we hear it as well as see it. What's worse, we hear it at the same time as we see it. Even if sound waves could travel in space, which they can't, the speed of a pressure wave such as sound is generally orders of magnitude smaller than the speed of light. You don't have to go farther than the football game to discover that you can see things before you can hear them. I had never taken much notice of the sound in space, or lack of it, in the series. However, after Steven Weinberg and several others mentioned that they had remembered sound associated with Star Trek explosions, I checked the episode I just watched, A Matter of Perspective, the one in which the Tanuga 4 space station explodes. Sure enough, kaboom. The same thing happened in the next episode I watched, when a shuttle which was carrying stolen trilithium crystals away from the Enterprise blew up with a loud bang near the planet Arcaria. I next went to the most recent Star Trek movie, Generations. There, even a bottle of champagne makes noise when it explodes in space. 2. Faster than a speeding phaser. While faster than light warp travel is something we must live with in Star Trek, such a possibility relies on all the subtleties of general relativity and exotic new forms of matter, as I've described. But for normal objects, doing everyday kinds of things, light speed is, and always will be, the ultimate barrier. Sometimes this simple fact is forgotten. In a wild episode called Wink of an Eye, Kirk is tricked by the Scalosians into drinking a potion that speeds up his actions by a huge amount to the Scalosian level, so that he can become a mate for their queen, Dela. The Scalosians live in a hyper-accelerated existence and cannot be sensed by the Enterprise's crew. Before bedding the queen, Kirk first tries to shoot her with his phaser. However, since she can move in the wink of an eye by normal human standards, she moves out of the way before the beam can hit her. Now, what's wrong with this picture? The answer is everything. What has been noticed by some trekkers is that the accelerated existence required for Dela to move significantly in the time it would take a phaser beam to move at the speed of light across the room would make the rest of the episode impossible. Light speed is 300 million meters per second. Dela is about a meter or so away from Kirk when he fires, implying a light travel time of about 1/300,000,000th of a second. For this time to appear to take a second or so for her, the Skolosian clock must be faster by a factor of 300 million. However, if this is so, 300 million Skolosian seconds take 1 second in normal Enterprise time. Unfortunately, 300 million seconds is about 10 years. Okay, let's forgive the Star Trek writers this lapse. Nevertheless, there is a much bigger problem, which is impossible to solve, and which several physicists I know have leapt upon. Phasers are, we are told, directed energy weapons, so that the phaser beam travels at the speed of light. Sorry, but no matter how fast one moves, even if one is sped up by a factor of 300 million, one can never move out of the way of an oncoming phaser beam. Why? Because in order to know it is coming, you have to first see the gun being fired, but the light that allows you to see this travels at the same speed as the beam. Put simply, it is impossible to know what is going to hit you until it hits you. As long as phaser beams are energy beams, there is no escape. 3. If the plot isn't cracked, maybe the event horizon is. While I said I wouldn't dwell on technobabble, I can't help mentioning that the Voyager series wins in that department hands down. Every piece of jargon known to modern physics is thrown in as the Voyager tries to head home, traveling in time with the regularity of a commuter train. However, physics terms usually mean something, so that when you use them as a plot device, you're bound to screw up every now and then. The crack in the event horizon that saves the day for the Voyager, in the feckless phage episode, sounds especially ludicrous to physicists. A crack in an event horizon is like removing one end of a circle, or like being a little bit pregnant. It doesn't mean anything. The event horizon around a black hole is not a physical entity, but rather a location inside of which all trajectories remain inside the hole. It is a property of curved space that the trajectory of anything, including light, will bend back towards the hole once you are inside of a certain radius. Either the event horizon exists, in which case a black hole exists, or it doesn't. There is no middle ground big enough to slip a needle through, much less the Voyager. 4. How solid a guy is a doctor? I must admit that the technological twist I like the most in the Voyager series is the holographic doctor. There is a wonderful scene in which a patient asks the doctor how he can be solid if he's only a hologram. This is a good question. The doctor answers by turning off a magnetic confinement beam to show that without it, he is as non-corporeal as a mirage. He then orders the beam turned back on so that he can slap the poor patient around. It's a great moment, but unfortunately, it's also an impossible one. Magnetic confinement works wonders for charged particles, which experience a force in a constant magnetic field that causes them to move in circular orbits. However, light is not charged. It experiences no force in a magnetic field. Since a hologram is no more than a light image, neither is the doctor. 5. Which is more sensitive, your hands or your butt? Or, to interface or not to interface? Star Trek has on occasion committed what I call the infamous ghost error. I refer to a recent movie by this name in which the main character, a ghost, walks through walls and cannot lift objects because his hand passes through them. However, miraculously, whenever he sits on a chair or a couch, his butt manages to stay put. Likewise, the ground seems pretty firm beneath his feet. I described earlier how Geordi LaForge and Ro Laren were rendered out of phase with normal matter by a Romulan interphase generator. They discovered to their surprise that they were invisible and could walk through walls and people, leading Ro, at least, to believe that she was dead. Perhaps she saw a replay of Ghost at some old movie house in her youth. Yet Geordi and Ro could stand on the floor and sit on chairs with impunity. Matter is matter, and chairs and floors are no different from walls, and as far as I know, feet and butts are no more or less solid than hands. Incidentally, there's another fatal flaw associated with this particular episode, which also destroys the consistency of a number of other Star Trek dramas. In physics, two things that both interact with something else will always be able to interact with each other. This leads us full circle back to Newton's first law. If I exert a force on you, you exert an equal and opposite force on me. Thus, if Geordi and Ro could observe the Enterprise from their new phase, they could interact with light, an electromagnetic wave. By Newton's law, if nothing else, they in turn should have been visible. Glass is invisible precisely because it does not absorb visible light. In order to see, that is to sense light, you have to absorb it. By absorbing it, you must disturb it. If you disturb light, you must also be visible to someone else. The same goes for the invisible interphase insects that invaded the Enterprise by clinging to the bodies of the crew in the Next Generation episode of Phantasms. The force that allows them to rest on normal matter without going through it is nothing other than electromagnetism, the electrostatic repulsion between the charged particles making up the atoms in one body with the atoms in another body. Once you interact electromagnetically, you are part of our world. There is no such thing as a free lunch. 6. Sweeping out the baby with the bathwater. In the Next Generation episode, Starship Mine, the Enterprise docks at the Remler Array to have a baryon sweep. It seems that these particles build up on Starship superstructures as a result of long-term travel at warp speed and must be removed. During the sweep, the crew must evacuate because the removal beam is lethal to living tissue. Well, it certainly would be. The only stable baryons are protons and neutrons in atomic nuclei. Since these particles make up everything we see, ridding the Enterprise of them wouldn't leave much of it for future episodes. 7. How cold is cold? The favorite Star Trek gaffe of my colleague and fellow Star Trek aficionado, Chuck Rosenblatt, involves an object being frozen to a temperature of minus 295 degrees Celsius. This is a very exciting discovery, because on the Celsius scale, absolute zero is minus 273 degrees. Absolute zero, as the name implies, is the lowest temperature anything can potentially attain, because it is defined as the temperature at which all molecular and atomic motions, vibrations, and rotations cease. Though it is impossible to achieve this theoretical zero temperature, atomic systems have been cooled to within a millionth of a degree above it. Since temperature is associated with molecular and atomic motion, you can never get less than no motion at all. Hence, even 400 years from now, absolute zero will still be absolute. 8. I have seen the light. I am embarrassed to say that this obvious error, which I should have caught myself, was in fact pointed out to me by a first-year physics student, Ryan Smith, when I was lecturing to his class and mentioned that I was writing the book on which this tape is based. Whenever the Enterprise shoots a phaser beam, we see it. But of course, this is impossible unless the phaser beam itself emits light in all directions. Light is not visible unless it reflects off something. If you have ever been to a lecture given with the help of a laser pointer, generally these are helium neon red lasers, you may recall that you see only the spot where the beam hits the screen and not anything in between. The only way to make the whole beam visible is to make the room dusty by clapping chalkboard erasers together or something like that. You should try this sometime. The light show is really quite spectacular. Laser light shows are created by bouncing the laser light off either smoke or water. Unless empty space is particularly dusty, we shouldn't see the phaser beam except where it hits. 9. Astronomers get picky. Perhaps it's not surprising to find that the physics errors various people uncover in the series are often closely related to their own areas of interest. One astronomy student turned a valiant effort by the Star Trek writers to use a piece of real astronomy into an error. The energy-eating life form in Galaxy's Child is an infant space creature who mistakes the Enterprise for its mother and begins draining its energy. Just in the nick of time, LaForge comes up with a way to get the baby to let go. The baby is attracted to the radiation the Enterprise is emitting at a wavelength of 21 centimeters. By changing the frequency of the emission, the crew spoils the milk and the baby lets go. What makes this episode interesting and at the same time incorrect is that the writers picked up on the fact that 21 centimeter radiation is a universal frequency emitted by hydrogen, which astronomers use to map out interstellar gas. However, the writers interpreted this to mean that everything radiates at 21 centimeters, including the Enterprise. In fact, the atomic transition in hydrogen responsible for this radiation is extremely rare, so that a particular atom in interstellar space might produce such radiation on average only once every 400 years. Because the universe is filled with hydrogen, the 21 centimeter signal is strong enough to detect on Earth. So in this case, I would give the writers A for effort and reduce this grade to a B+ for the misinterpretation. but I am known as an easy grader. 10. Those darn neutrinos. I suppose I can't help but bring up neutrinos again, and since I've skipped lightly over Deep Space Nine in this tape, perhaps it is fair to finish with a blooper from this series, one I was told about by David Brom, another physicist Trekker. It seems that Quark has gotten hold of a machine that alters the laws of probability in its vicinity. One can imagine how useful this would be at his gaming tables, providing the kind of unfair advantage that a Ferengi couldn't resist. This ruse is discovered, however, by Dax, who happens to analyze the neutrino flux through the space station. To her surprise, she finds that all neutrinos are coming through left-handed, that is, spinning in one direction relative to their motion. Something must be wrong. The neutrinos that spin in the opposite direction seem to be missing. Unfortunately, of all the phenomena the Star Trek writers could have chosen to uncover Quark's shenanigans, they managed to pick one that is actually true. As far as we know, neutrinos are only left-handed. They are the only known particles in nature that can apparently exist in only one spin state. If Dax's analysis had yielded this information, she would have every reason to believe that all was as it should be. What makes this example so poignant, as far as I'm concerned, is exactly what makes the physics of Star Trek so interesting. Sometimes truth is indeed stranger than fiction. Well, that's it for blunders and for physics. If I missed your favorite error, or your favorite piece of physics, I suppose you can send your suggestion to my publisher. If there are enough, like Star Trek, we can plan a sequel. I already have a name. The Physics of Star Trek II, The Wrath of Kraus. The point of finishing this tape with physics blunders is not to castigate the Star Trek writers unduly. It is rather to illustrate that there are many ways of enjoying the series. As long as Star Trek continues to remain on the air, I'm sure that ever new physics faux pas will give Trekkers of all ilks, from high school students to university professors, something to look forward to talking about the morning after. And it offers a challenge to the writers and producers to try and keep up with the expanding world of physics. So I will instead close this tape where I began, not with the mistakes, but with the possibilities. Our culture has been as surely shaped by the miracles of modern physics, and here I include Galileo and Newton among the moderns, as it has by any other human intellectual endeavor. And while it is an unfortunate modern misconception that science is somehow divorced from culture, it is in fact a vital part of what makes up our civilization. Our explorations of the universe represent some of the most remarkable discoveries of the human intellect, and it's a pity that they are not shared among as broad an audience as enjoys the inspirations of great literature or painting or music. By emphasizing the potential role of science in the development of the human species, Star Trek whimsically displays the powerful connection between science and culture. While I have argued at times that the science of the 23rd century may bear very little resemblance to anything the imagination of the Star Trek writers have come up with, nevertheless, I expect that this science may be even more remarkable. In any case, I am convinced that the physics of today and tomorrow will as surely determine the character of our future as the physics of Newton and Galileo colors our present existence. I suppose I am a scientist in part because of my faith in the potential of our species to continue to uncover the hidden wonders in the universe. And this is, after all, the spirit animating the Star Trek series. Perhaps Gene Roddenberry should have the last word. As he said on the 25th anniversary of the Star Trek series, 1 year before his death, "The human race is a remarkable creature, one with great potential, and I hope that Star Trek has helped to show us what we can be if we believe in ourselves and our abilities."